This is episode 211, recorded June 19th, 2014.
Greetings, Aquarimaxers.
Do you know what today is?
Yes.
What?
Episode 211.
You know what else today is?
It is the date of birth of a certain famous cartoon cat.
It is. It's Garfield's birthday. I don't know if Garfield's ever published outside of the U.S. or not, but he was a cartoon cat, and he always made me laugh when I was a cat. I mean, when I was a kid.
Kelly's birthday is is a day before Garfield's.
Yes, my birthday was yesterday.
Yeah.
But that's not why I brought it up, though, just because it's Garfield's birthday.
I know, but I wanted to bring it up.
Okay.
I like your birthday.
I like it, too. It means I was born.
Yeah, that's part of the reason I like it.
So, we have several people today. We have David in Garland, Texas. Wendell in Port Richey, Florida. That's cool. We had a goldfish named Wendell.
We did.
Actually, his whole name was Wendell the Wet because we had this pirate theme going on.
Yeah.
And we had Peter O'Finn again.
Mm-hmm.
And who else did we have?
Calico Jack.
Calico Jack. Black Eyed Susan.
We still have
Black Eyed Susan. We had Wendell the Wet. He was a blackamoor. Anyways, Wendell in Port Richey, Florida is most likely not a blackamoor with telescope eyes. He's probably a human being.
Yes.
Just to clarify. Mick in Carnforth, UK. Jeremiah in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Robert in Tallahassee, Florida. So.
Okay. Cool.
Shall we get started?
Yes. Okay. So first, David in Garland, Texas sent us couple of Google Voice messages.
Mm-hmm. Although he did ask us not to actually play them, so we won't.
We won't, but we're going to...
We're just going to sum up.
Yeah. Oh, well, one thing he wanted to talk about was the large water changes that we've talked about before on the show, especially, I think he cited episode 182. Okay. And there's the article in Tropical Fish Hobbyist that was about that, and we talked about that. Several listeners chimed in on it, and he wants to say that he... it works for him. He did 90% water changes on his tanks, and he had some situations that forced him to relinquish his tank. So he doesn't have any right now. He had several big ones. Yes, mm-hmm. He's hoping to get back into it. But he said that he would do 90% water changes. He would make sure the water sprayed in, so it was like a fine mist when it sprayed in.
Which wasn't just a hard stream of water,
right? Which helps reduce the gas bubbles.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what he was, you know, that's why he did that, because it reduces the gas bubbles that enter in and then can cause problems for the fish if you do it as a mist. He said he used Seachem Prime, which is my favorite dechlorinator, by the way. That's
Yay.
What I use most of the time. And he also uses Stability. He said when he had to move his tanks, and he had big ones, I think his biggest one was 125.
And he had to move them quickly, he said.
He had to set them back up quickly. He used Seachem Stability with good results. He never had any fish
losses. So what does that do, Seachem Stability?
It's a biological filtration, yes.
Thing?
Yes.
Okay.
It's to kickstart biological filtration with bacteria. And he said he also uses their Matrix product. And then this is one thing he did for the water, which I would love to do this. I think this is a great way to do it. He would use the stock tanks from Rubbermaid. It says you can get a 100-gallon one.
And those are like the troughs, right? The Rubbermaid animal troughs, basically, that people water them
Yeah,
in.
A stock tank is a water tank for animals, yeah.
For like hoof stock and...
Uh-huh. Yes, and people use them for other things, too.
Right.
I mean, they use them in aquaponics and different things.
And...
Yeah. But that's what they're sold as, stock tanks. And he says you can get 100 gallons in his area for $70, including tax.
Which is really good.
Pretty good for 100 gallons.
Mm-hmm.
And he says he would fill that up. And he kept, you know, the legal native fish. So he would put the... He didn't need to put a heater in it. He would just keep the tank at room temperature, keep the stock tank at room temperature, put an air stone in it, and let the water kind of gas out. And then he would use a water pump to pump it up into his tanks. And he said it was a really convenient way to do it. Probably filled it up with the hose. Really easy to do.
Mm-hmm.
And sounds like a very good method to do it. Now, I would say that using that method, I can't see anything wrong at all with doing the huge water changes. I think that's perfect. You know, do a 90% water change if you have that set up, in my opinion, too. In other words, I'm agreeing with David mm-hmm. that his method is awesome. I found in my situation currently that if I do a water change in our goldfish tank higher than about 50%, we get problems. One of our goldfish is uncomfortable for a while.
She gets bubbly.
Yeah. And so what I've done is I now do about 50%, which is not ideal, but it's better than, you know,
20.
And I would totally do 90%, probably do 90% twice a week if I could, but it's just not going to work right now with our situation. No, we have two goldfish right now. One of them is totally fine with a 90%, or, well, usually what I would do before is 60 to 70, sometimes maybe 80% changes for a while to see how it was going. And Pondy was fine with it. Mm-hmm. No worries at
but
all.
But she's like a normal body shape.
She's like
goldfish.
A pond comet.
Black-eyed Susan is a fancy, so she's got the fat body.
Yeah, like a fantail.
They just get bubblier.
They get bubblier because their swim bladder's compacted mm-hmm. because of their body distortion and stuff. So, yeah, she doesn't handle it as well. But if we were to do it as he is able to do it with the Rubbermaid stock tank and let the air gas out first, it would work perfectly, I'm sure. And I hope that we can someday do that, but right now we don't have a room for a stock tank. But someday I hope we can, because I think it's an awesome idea mm-hmm. to do it that way. And even if we had a trash barrel, that would be something, but we don't even have room for a trash barrel right now.
No, we barely have room for the tank.
And one thing I appreciate it always when our listeners say things that they like about the show, and David chimed in on that. He said that he really likes the show. He enjoys what we're doing, and we're helping people, and it makes him feel good to listen to the show. And so we really appreciate it when people say things like that. So thank you mm-hmm. for saying that. And we hope we can continue to do that. Sorry the show's a day late this week. But
it was a crazy week.
Yeah. But
I don't even remember Mondays when we usually recorded. And I know there was something going on that prevented us from doing it, but I can't even remember what it was.
But at least we're day late instead of missing a week.
Yeah.
And David also mentioned that he just got married, so congratulations.
Congratulations.
That's cool. And we're glad that you're getting back into the hobby now, and that you're listening to our show. So thank you for being a contributor. We hope to hear from you again soon.
Okay. Sorry, guys. See, that's the kind of week that...
Okay.
Okay. Wendell.
And Wendell.
Wendell's in Florida.
He's from Port Richey, Florida. Mm-hmm. Uh-huh.
He says, hello.
He's new.
He is new.
Welcome, Wendell.
Welcome, Wendell. I recently found your podcast, and I have been enjoying catching up on the archived episodes. Thank you both for all your hard work on this entertaining and informative show. You are most welcome.
Indeed.
I have some questions that I'd love to get your feedback on. I'll give you a little background. I currently have 55, 54, 40, 29, 15, and 10-gallon aquariums.
Cool.
I recently converted the 10-gallon to a nano saltwater, my first saltwater tank, and consequently have been learning a lot about saltwater ecosystems. I started to question why we don't use deep sand beds and live rock as filtration for our freshwater systems. I've done a lot of looking, but found very little on this topic. The little bit that I did find suggests that it should work with something like lava rock, which is very porous. So my first question is, do you have any experience with freshwater deep sand beds and or using lava rock or something similar as live rock in a freshwater aquarium?
Okay. Great question. Let's address that, and then we can go into other stuff, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. One thing is that I have experimented a little bit with that kind of stuff. I had I think it's about 4.5-gallon tank with a dwarf puffer in it, and I set up kind of a lava rock sump, I guess, that was about a gallon.
Was that salt?
No, it was fresh water.
Okay.
That was auric
in
Hawaii.
Yes, yes.
And I had lava rock in the sump. And basically, I had the water draining out by a siphon from the main tank into the sump, and then had a pump in the sump and siphoned some of that back into the main tank because the filter was a lot higher than the water level in both tanks. So it kind of, I could cycle it that way, cycle the water in and out. And I think it worked pretty well. I'm sure that, there was a good bacterial bed on the lava rock that was helping with the filtration. I've also just put chunks of lava rock in various tanks, including as beds for, you know, like a surface for Java Fern or Anubias to hold on to. You know, I'll tie them to it or rubber band them to it and things like that. And I've had some tanks with quite an extensive bunch of lava rock that way, and I'm sure that also helps, because the idea behind live rock, I mean, there's several things that are going on, of course, but in a saltwater aquarium, one of them is that they have a lot of external surface area, but they also have a lot of internal surface area.
Surface area! Yeah. I gotta sing the song.
They're very porous. There you go, Tony. They're very porous, both of them. And like Wendell says, mm-hmm. And so the idea is that on the outside of the rock, you can get aerobic bacteria going. And on the inside, you can get anoxic and anaerobic bacteria going.
And what do?
They process different things.
Oh, okay.
The aerobic bacteria tend to process ammonia and nitrite. And the anoxic and anaerobic bacteria process nitrate, turn it to nitrogen gas, which then can then outgas to the atmosphere and not sit there as nitrates in the water.
Okay, I have an idea. Uh-huh. I mean, not an idea. I have a question.
Mm-hmm.
Live rock in saltwater also is a means of gaining critters.
Yes, it is.
In your tank. Mm-hmm. It's like a big grab bag. You don't know what's sleeping or has laid eggs or is dormant or whatever on the rock, and you put it in the water and it wakes up.
Right. And we've had experience that with that in our saltwater tanks.
That
right.
doesn't really happen with freshwater.
Right. If you were to go collect some rocks or pieces of wood
from a lake or
lake or something, you could get some things hatching, and it might be good, it might be bad, might be
you don't
fairly
know
neutral,
you're
not going to get. Yeah, but that's technically, you know, that's generally frowned upon in the freshwater hobby for various reasons. But yeah, so putting
what
the live rock
reasons?
In would have, well, you can get lots of parasites mm-hmm. and stuff that can
do
be
they, is there just not
diseases.
As high of a rate of parasites in salt water?
I wouldn't exactly say
or
that, but
people just like the risk.
Well, it's a whole different ecosystem. I mean, you definitely get parasites that show up in fresh salt water. Yes, mm-hmm. you do. But I think salt water is a whole different ecosystem where you're introducing copepods and amphipods and, you know, all kinds of other animals when you put in live rock.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, in a way, it's tends to outweigh the benefit, outweigh the disadvantages that you might introduce.
You get more good than
because you certainly introduce things like
Aptasia anemones.
You know, mantis shrimps and Aptasia anemones when you put in live rock. So it's not like it's all perfect.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that's the basic key, is that the advantages outweigh the disadvantages.
Okay.
In freshwater,
but
I think
it doesn't really do
technically
that
seen the other way. You're not as likely to introduce as much of a diversity of organisms when you do, but you are fairly likely to introduce something, you know, unpleasant
that
like hydro or leeches or, you know, whatever.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And another point is that when you introduce live rock, you're introducing something from a reef system to a reef system. When you introduce like a piece of driftwood that you pull out of a lake into a tropical fish tank, you're clashing ecosystem-wise.
Right.
So that's another thing.
You'd have to go someplace tropical to get something tropical to put in your tropical tank.
Right.
And half the time people don't have freshwater ecosystem tank. They have, you know, freshwater fish from this area of the world mixed in with fish from this area of the world.
Right.
And so it doesn't really.
So it's kind of a different thing. Yeah. But I think one of the reasons why people don't do this as much is because it's cheaper to do freshwater water changes, honestly. Cheaper and easier.
That's true.
One of the reasons we do it in saltwater is because you can keep nitrates very low by using live rock. And so you don't have to do water changes as frequently or as heavily. But freshwater is just cheap and easy to do water changes, and you don't need to worry about it as much. So
that's a good point.
But I'm not to say that it doesn't happen and that it can't happen.
What about sand beds?
Sandbeds.
I was asking about freshwater deep sand beds.
Yeah.
You know what makes me think of Diana's tanks, though?
Mm-hmm.
It's not sand.
Diana's tanks?
Diana Wallstedt.
Oh, Diana Wallstedt. Okay, yeah. Diana Wallstedt.
Sorry, maybe I shouldn't use
like
you were
talking about
name.
A friend of yours or something. No, it's okay.
Maybe I can call her my friend.
Well, I hope to think of her as a friend too, but I'm just saying, you know.
Yeah, sorry. I mean, she's not really using sand, but it's kind of maybe a freshwater equivalent if she's got the deep dirt bed, basically.
True, and there's definitely
lots of all kinds of live stuff going on.
A lot of bacteriological action that's happening in there.
In the tank.
It's true. And
don't know if it's really comparable or not, but
in a way, I mean, it's not exactly the same, but yeah, that's a good question about the deep sand beds. I know that there are a lot of people who try not to keep the substrate too deep if they're not doing plants, but in plants you typically want a fairly deep substrate, and that might be the closest equivalent. And a lot of times, or like a Wellsted tank, when you have the basically soil, like organic potting soil under a cap of sand or gravel, that's probably the closest equivalent. That's a good point. I'm glad you brought that up. Now, there are a couple of things to think about when you're thinking about doing this. One is that lava rock is not all created equal. Sometimes you'll get lava rock with different grades of porosity.
Sometimes you just said porosity.
I totally did.
That's the word of the day. That's okay. Pretty awesome.
And sometimes you can get other problems with lava rock. I've heard, I remember the pet fish talk guys talking about it, that sometimes you can get toxins in the rock. So I would say, and not that I haven't used it, but I usually tried to rinse it really well, soak it, pour it out, you know, do that several times, kind of leach out anything, hopefully, which it still, there are things that won't leach out, but it, you know, would take care of some of it. And then I usually test it. Like I'll put it in a tank with like one fish or something to see how it's doing. And after a few days, if it looks fine, then I'll say, okay, this is probably safe to use. Which sort of a, you know, an analysis by
a... Where are you getting that lava rock that you're doing this with?
You know, there are several places to get it. One of the most common places to get it is in at a garden store or a home improvement store with garden supplies.
Because they have big fat
bags. You can get big fat bags of it, and they're quite cheap. And the particle size tends to be pretty small, maybe between, you know, 2 inches across, 2 inches in diameter, and maybe half an inch in diameter, somewhere in there. Some people do that. I usually don't need that much at a time, and I want slightly bigger pieces. So I will go and get some in the grill section, the barbecue grill section. Mm-hmm. You can get a smaller bag, and it's...
They're bigger bits.
Bigger bits. They're usually cheaper per unit, but less per volume, you know. Per unit in terms of per bag. You buy a bag for cheaper than you could buy a big bag, but you're getting a lot less.
It's more per ounce or per pound or whatever.
And that's what I usually get, the grill type. One reason being that I figure that if they're having people cook their food over it, they might have some sort of check on
that maybe
whether it has toxins in it or not.
Doesn't have crap in it.
And I don't know that they do, but it makes me feel better. And the pieces are a bit bigger too, which I often want. So... but you can easily break it up into small pieces as well. So, let's go on to next what he says.
He says, also, I recently picked up a 120-gallon aquarium and a 60-gallon tall aquarium. In an effort to consolidate, I hatched a plan to use the 120 as a show tank with a 60-gallon refugium and an additional 30-gallon sump. This would give me around 200 gallons total capacity and the ability to keep most of my fish in one place. Since this is a fresh build, I can do pretty much whatever I want with it. So my second question is, do you have any thoughts on smart ways to set up or automate my new system? Like teeing off one of the return pumps onto a long hose for draining water to make water changes easier.
Well, you just had a good idea.
Teeing off, does he mean like a T-valve?
Basically, yeah.
Okay.
Where you can attach it either way so it can go either direction and just drain water out that way. I like that idea. That's lovely. I'll have to think about that, though. I should have given this some more thought before.
Your dream is to have all of our systems set up to a button in the wall that you push the button and it flushes out and refills.
Yeah, there are some systems sold that way. I would love that. Either that or just a flow through that.
Never planning on moving and you have a lot of money.
Yeah. Okay, well, let's go to his next idea and we can think about that.
Do some brainstorming on that and then we'll bring that up next issue.
Okay.
He says, one more thing. I have an idea for how to set up the refugium with lava rock. I'll attach a picture. Maybe that will make it easier to understand. But my idea is to have 5 compartments in the refugium. The first 4 will be filled with lava rock with the water coming in top of the first, exiting the bottom into the second, exiting the top of the second into the third, exiting the bottom of the third into the fourth, then spilling into the top of the fifth and largest compartment. My thought was to place a bunch of plants, possibly potted or planted in a sand substrate. The idea is that as water flows over the lava rock from one compartment to the next, it will lose oxygen to aerobic bacteria and allow for anoxic and anaerobic bacteria formation for denitrification. The plants in the last compartment will help uptake nitrates and also introduce oxygen back into the water, along with some water turbulence for adding more oxygen. Sorry if that explanation was a bit dry, but I hope you get the idea. Your thoughts on the matter would be greatly appreciated.
Okay, and he put some illustrations up for us on the email. He did a back of the envelope, a literal back of the envelope
literally
illustration.
Literally on the back of the envelope.
And we're going to take a look at that now, because I've seen it, but Kelly has not seen it yet, so I want to show her what it looks like.
Gavin likes to show me these things live so that I actually react live.
Yeah, I think it's...
it's more fun.
It's more fun. Oh, goodness. Let's see, I'm having a little bit trouble pulling this up because I think... I can't remember if it was an Aquarimax comment.
I think I get the picture of it, though.
Right.
Yeah.
But I want to find... I want to see if I can find something. Find the picture because I think it's good to refer to it anyway. There it is. I spelled his name wrong. It was a problem. I put two L's. Okay. Go ahead and click on that. And now it's opening up here.
And we'll put the picture up too, I suppose.
Yeah.
Yes?
Yeah, we can do that. See? There you go. So the water comes in through and it goes up and out and up and out and then to the place of the plants and then the pump tanks it back to the normal tank.
I think it's a good idea.
Yeah. Well, you know what this reminds me of, my first thought, what this reminds me of is the type of filter. There's a Lavaroc, do-it-yourself Lavaroc filter done in like a Rubbermaid tub that is widely used in freshwater ponds with goldfish, with koi, that sort of thing, where they'll get one or more Rubbermaid tubs and then they'll get some sort of, you know, mechanical filter. They'll have the water coming from the pond into the filter and go through like a filter sock or, you know, some padding of some sort of basket that has some sort of mechanical media in it. And then the rest of the thing is filled with Lavaroc, one or more chambers of Lavaroc. So it's very similar in a lot of ways. And then many times that will be the output from that Rubbermaid tub will be into a veggie filter, either one that's built into the pond where it goes straight out into a big bed of plants, like emergent plants, or into another tub that has a whole bunch of, you know, immersed plants. So it's very, very similar to that, and it sounds like that. You know what? I'm just going to take a little break to tell the kids that they're being a little bit loud. So I'll be right back. All right, there. We're back.
Usually we record this after they've gone to bed, but yeah. It's daytime right now. So.
Yes. So, where were we?
Well,
I got lost.
I think you're around in here.
Okay. Yes, we're talking about the filters with the pond filter. So I would say one profitable direction for you to go, Wendell, would be to look at, you know, do a Google search for do-it-yourself pond filter Rubbermaid tub Lavaroc. See what comes up. There are all sorts of plans available that would help you inform this build. I think your general plan is very sound. I think it works well. I probably wouldn't change anything. Although I wouldn't add the sand bed because it would be murder to clean.
It would be messy.
That's my first thought. But the Lavaroc works, I think. And I might actually try to keep shrimp in it.
Just like with the
like
plants.
We've talked about in a couple of recent episodes. In with the plants and with the Lavaroc, just so they can pick bits off of stuff.
That's a good idea.
Keep it from too much bacterial buildup, you know. Because as he says, maybe I said that. Who said that? I don't know. I got some notes here. But the way you have it set up so that each chamber reduces the oxygen because the beneficial bacteria are going to be changing ammonia to nitrite and nitrite to nitrate, that seems very sound. It's very similar to a setup that the Bailey brothers on Pet Fish Talk did. And so you might want to look that up too. They built a denitrifier out of a long tube of
PVC
that they filled with Lavaroc and they pumped the water through it. And what they found is that, initially, I think what they reported is initially the bacteria were doing, just as you said, they were processing the ammonia and nitrite. But as it got closer to the end of the tube, by the time the bacteria weren't having much oxygen, so they were different bacteria and they were dealing with nitrate instead. And by the time the water came back out of the tube, there wasn't much oxygen left in it, but there wasn't much nitrate either. It was really low. So
they just had to get the water all stirred up to put more oxygen back in
Yeah.
afterwards.
But yeah, so I think it is a sound idea. Here's a couple of caveats and ideas. As we were talking about, the lava rock could contain toxins, so I would test your bed of lava rock with some, you know, organisms. I hate to do that, but I don't know. It's better to test it with one than test it with 70 fish mm-hmm. that then die. You know what I mean? Here's something, too. I know that in aquaponics, which is, you know, kind of a related to our hobby because it involves keeping fish, it can... They discourage the use of lava rock because of the fact that it can affect pH.
Oh.
Because in an aquaponics system, you really want the pH to stay as close to 7.0 neutral mm-hmm. as possible. Works best for the particular parameters you're going for with plant growth and whatnot. So they say that, and I can't recall honestly if the lava rock goes one direction or the other, but they say it can cause problems. And I think there are some other issues that they cite with it. So another possibility would be to look into lightweight expanded clay aggregate instead of lava rock. It's basically like terracotta in balls that are kind of like almost popped like popcorn. So they're mm-hmm. these round balls. They're lightweight. They're porous. They're inert. They don't affect pH. They have an immense amount of surface area internally and externally.
Well, that sounds like something worth looking into.
Yeah. And so they're smaller than the lava rock. They're about, you know, they vary in size actually, but they tend to be smaller than the pieces of lava rock, maybe half an inch to 3/4 inch or something like that, just spheres. And there are alternatives to that too.
Where do you get them?
Well, you can, hydroponic stores are one good source. Okay. You can buy it on Amazon. Pet stores actually sell it for use as a drainage layer in vivariums, but it's kind of expensive if you go that route. I would say the hydroponics route is going to be cheaper.
Store is going to be better.
Yeah, but he's not going to look into a huge amount of it either, so mm-hmm. that's a good thing. I mean, aquaponics uses huge amounts of it, so hydroponic store would be a good way to go. There are alternatives, too. Like, there's a recycled glass product that is very similar. I have some of that over there, the drainage layer in that vivarium. Mm-hmm. I'm pointing for Kelly's benefit. I know you guys at home listening can't see that. But it's called Feather Light, and that might be an option too. So, you know, you could look into that. And the cleaning, it is going to be something to think about, and I think a few shrimp in with the lava rock might help. And the plants, of course, are an excellent idea. And one thing, though, you might even find that the lava rock is so efficient at processing the nitrates that there's not going to be enough left over for the plants. It depends on your bioload and your fish tank and so on. But I know that some people create veggie filters, especially when they have like a big bioload in their main tank and they're expecting, you know, large amounts of nitrates, that rather than using the lava rock, which is a good idea and is definitely a possibility, I think it's a practical way to go, but they'll just build a veggie filter in their sump.
What does that mean, a veggie filter?
It, basically, it's just what all you do, plants? It, you just, yeah, you light it. Sometimes, depending
on... You light
on,
it?
Yeah,
oh, you like use with a light. I'm yeah. thinking with a match. And mm-hmm. I'm going, no, that mm-hmm. can't be what you meant.
No. Some people, it depends on what you have in your main tank. If you have a heavily planted main tank, like your display tank is heavily planted, sometimes they will alternate the light cycle so that one's lit while the other's dark.
Mm-hmm.
And if you do that, the benefit is that your pH doesn't swing as much with the use of carbon dioxide in the water. And so that's a good thing to think about. And the plants can very effectively remove nitrates, especially if you use plants that are either floating at the surface or actually emerging from the surface of the water, where they're taking nutrients out of the water column, but then they're gaining CO2 from the water, from the air. Because it's a limiting factor. You know, the CO2. So if it's in the atmosphere, it's not really limiting nearly as much because they're pulling a lot more of it. And so you can get immensely fast, healthy plant growth. And then you just trim and remove that, and basically you're getting nitrate export that way.
Okay.
And so you might want to think about that if you just look into doing a veggie filter. And again, you can do a search on that to find out more about that. Instead of a lava filter, the lava rock filter, or you could do a combination of both, or you could just do the lava filter with a few plants. But I think, you know, kind of it would be good to weigh the benefits and disadvantages of both. Now, But it will be a good way to take advantage of all that atmospheric CO2 to grow some emergent plants there, and you can really, really reduce nitrates for heavy bioloads in big tanks.
Okay.
Well, and again, hopefully that gives you a good start, some things to think about, and welcome to the world of Aquarimax.
Okay, let's go to Mick.
Mm-hmm.
He says, "Hi guys, glad to hear Russ is back in the land of the living."
Oh, thank you.
We are glad about that.
Significantly more alive.
Just wanted to follow up on the remark about frozen food on the last show. I recently tried the frozen foods from a company that supplies us with live fish. On delivery, all the blister packs were soft, and the rodents for the reptiles were defrosted too. I called in the problem as soon as I opened the box to be told by the firm that, quote, "they are designed that way to be defrosted and refrozen with no problems," end quote.
Hmm.
Yeah, you can't... He wouldn't do that with, like, meat at a grocery store, because it goes bad. He says, "I had to argue the case for some time before they accepted it to be returned, explaining that it would be the first and last time we ordered frozen goods from them." Good job, Mick.
Yeah, I agree.
Mm-hmm. It just made me wonder how many shops get such information and feel happy to refreeze and sell on. It can be very hard to tell with some of the frozen packaged foods. I suppose that people just have to go on the trust that a shop has a good policy and supply chain for its frozen foods. I also wondered if the food I sent back would be refrozen by the supply company and sold on again to someone else who possibly receives it defrosted. Just how many times could a package be thawed and refrozen before it is used? Scary stuff.
Ooh, scary stuff indeed. Scary. Now, I'm glad you brought this up, Mick. This is perfect case in point for what we were talking about last time with the frozen food. And the comment that they are designed that way to be defrosted and refrozen with no problems, that really gives me pause.
That's got to be total bunk. Me.
Well, I'm willing to admit that they may have some sort of process that they know of that I'm ignorant of. That's possible.
But it seems like if there is a process like that, it would strip the food of any and all nutrition.
If anybody knows about it, how that could possibly be, please let me know.
I'm just thinking of this in like human terms. If a grocery store supplier said that, they'd be in so much trouble.
Well, yeah.
You know what I mean?
Well, and here's some things to think about. When a store, when a company sells a frozen product, typically it has been flash frozen.
Mm-hmm.
And when it's flash frozen, of course, it's frozen at a much lower temperature, freezes faster. Very much quickly, yeah, much more quickly. And when it does so, the crystals that form are not the sharp sorts of crystals that form when you freeze it slowly like we do in a home freezer. And so such a product is less likely to be damaged by thawing that first time.
But then if it gets refrozen,
because basically on the cellular level, as I understand it, if you are freezing very quickly, crystals, sharp crystals, do not form and puncture the cell membranes and or cell walls, depending on what kind of organism we're talking about here, whether it's plant or animal matter. The sharp crystals puncture the cell wall. If it's frozen quickly, or cell membrane, if it's frozen very quickly, that doesn't tend to happen as much. And so when you thaw it, you don't get a soggy mess.
Mm-hmm.
But when you take something out of a freezer, a home freezer, those sharp crystals have just played havoc with all the cellular structure. So everything becomes very leaky.
I wasn't worried so much about leaking as just if you're freezing and then thawing and then refreezing and rethawing and refreezing and rethawing, you get bacteria growth.
Well, right. And that's part of the reason I think that bacterial growth is more common after you do a home freezer type thing.
Because
the cell membranes are all punctured and so on. And it's leaking in a way like if you put frozen brine shrimp that's been frozen, flash frozen once into a fish tank and then it thaws, it's likely to retain, you know, some of its integrity.
If it's thawed when it gets to the pet store, the pet store is not flash freezing
The pet store is not flash freezing it.
It's just sticking it in a normal freezer.
Right. And then when it thaws, it's going to be juice. It's going to be brine shrimp smoothie.
Ugh.
And the water, you know, it'll all leak out into the water and the fish is not getting a lot in terms of whatever nutrients happen to be in the brine shrimp, which is not.
Because they're swimming in them instead.
Right. And brine shrimp aren't exactly the highest nutrient packed food anyway, but they're going to lose whatever they've got in that sort of situation. So, you know, I'm willing to admit that I may be ignorant of something, but I'm on Mick's side here. I think that it's pretty ridiculous sort of claim without any backup of how that's going on. And I would be really worried that exactly what he said, that if this is being frozen and thawed and they're telling people, oh, it's fine, when it's not fine, then that's scary.
That is scary.
But if anybody knows, I don't want to, you know, say that I'm the authority on freezing food. I just, this is what I understand. If somebody from maybe a company were to contact me and they were able to explain to our satisfaction why that is not the case, I'd be willing to hear it. I just, I don't understand
how it could work.
How it could work.
Yeah.
So I think Mick was on the right track sending that back and kind of putting the word out there to warn people, because that's an important thing to think about.
Excuse me.
Thank you,
he
Mick.
He has one more thing. He says, on the subject of substrate spawning killies, there's a pet fish talk show which might help. And he sent us the links so we can
We'll post that up. Yeah. Yeah, that's a good idea. I've listened to that. It's a good listen and has a lot of good information that could help Carlos in New York. So thank you, Mick. Okay.
Jeremiah. Where's Jeremiah?
Jeremiah's in Grand Rapids, Michigan.
Oh, right. Okay. He says, hello again. Thank you for confirming my shrimpy suspicions and for the advice on retaining CO2. I was glad to have the show and both of you back last week. Hopefully the plague doesn't recirculate. Amen. As promised, I purchased some lava rock, and I actually forgot to mention I already had an anubias of some kind in the fluorite with my shrimp, so I fastened that to the rock with a rubber band. I'll split the rhizome so I have two sections. Once this specimen has rooted to the rock, I'll get more anubias. One problem I had, I tried breaking up some of the lava rock with a hammer, but only succeeded in hurting my hand and annoying my wife.
There's a story behind that.
Yeah. In the current state, the remaining pieces are bigger than I'd like. Do I need to do something more complicated than clubbing like a crazed Cro-Magnon?
Whoa, he gets the alliteration award of the day, doesn't he?
Yep, that was good.
Okay. I would say the clubbing technique is what I usually use. But I'll do this. I usually put it in a bag, a couple of layers of plastic bags. Usually like a, what do I use? A lot of times I'll get a quart freezer bag because they have fairly thick.
They're thicker than fairly thick plastic.
Put it in two layers of that, and then I don't have to hold it because it's not going to go flying, and so I'm not, less likely to hit my hand. Just hold the edge of the bag, and I hit it with a hammer.
You usually do it outside, though.
I do. I usually set it
on the kitchen table,
a slab of on the patio,
on the concrete,
or the driveway, or something, in a spot that's not likely to get any damage if I hit it. You know, where it's already gotten some wear or whatever, so it doesn't matter. And I will hit it there, and that tends to work fairly well. I usually get pieces of the size that I want, and I can still see what I'm working with because it's a transparent bag. And so I get things down to size, and you don't have to hit it very hard. Sometimes you do, but a lot of times you don't have to hit it very hard as long as you can do a precision hit, which is easier to do when you don't have to worry about hitting yourself and stuff. And you may have already done something like this. I'm envisioning you hurting your hand by trying to hold a piece and hit it, you know, with controlled hits, but we're all human and we all miss sometimes, so... I'm, you know, wondering if that might help a little bit. So you can try that or tell us, you know, more about what the method you used and maybe we can compare notes.
Yeah.
In terms of the Anubias, yeah, I'm glad that's working. Glad you already had some. That stuff is marvelous. It's like the plastic plant that grows. It never dies. It's really cool. You can have it in, you know, almost ambient light and it still just goes to town in flowers and everything. Lovely stuff. So. Mm-hmm. Good thing. All right, I think
one more. It's just a picture. Robert in Florida, Tallahassee, Florida, says, I put the guppies out the first week in May. Here's what it looks like today.
Okay.
So we'll put that picture up.
Yeah, he's got...
I think I actually saw it while you were looking for the other one, yeah.
Okay. Yeah, he's got some good stuff. There he is, right here.
Mm-hmm.
This is his outdoor guppy setup with all these lovely plants. It looks like he's got, maybe that's Vallisneria or Sagittaria, Subulata or something like that, some Anacharias. Going on. And this is the, like, one of those tanks, like a stock tank.
Right. And there's all the fishies coming to eat in the little feeding ring.
Yeah. So we'll put these cool pictures up for you to check out his setup and how it's looking after it's been outside about a month. So.
Okay. I think that's everything today.
So, just one quick note. Remember the baby geckos? I know this is kind of a tangent, but we had two last time. We have four babies. Another clutch of egg hatched.
Four baby geckos. They're so cute.
It's been really fun to watch them grow.
They're pretty friendly too. They like to come out and crawl in our hands.
They do. They get a big kick out of that. They get their little constitutional every day. Joe was right. Joe from Facebook. He said pretty soon you'll have 97 of these. Well, started out with three originally. We now have six, so it's coming along because there's that one that escaped. But
we lost one of the adults.
Yeah, but other than that, we have double the amount we started with, so exponential growth.
Woohoo!
Next year we might have 97. Who knows? Okay, so may the fish
be with you.